Hello, and welcome to Season 2 of Historically Speaking Podcast, Uncommon History, with an unconventional pair. I'm Rebecca Robbins.
And I'm Kim Kimmel.
I'm a singer and actress.
And I'm a retired history teacher.
He was my history teacher in college.
And now we've been married for 22 years.
Sometimes quirky, sometimes obscure.
But this is the kind of history you actually want to remember.
Hello, and welcome to episode 40 of Historically Speaking Podcast.
Yeah, I can't believe it's the 40th episode.
We made it to 40 episodes.
I know, when we first started this, if you had told me we were going to end up with 40 episodes, I would have been dubious.
Well, here's to you, Mr. Dubious. Today, for our 40th episode, I think we have a fascinating person.
Yes.
Whatever you might think of him.
Very enigmatic.
He's fascinating.
Extraordinary human being.
Mm-hmm. And that is...
That is Thomas Edward Lawrence, much better known as Lawrence of Arabia.
T.E. Lawrence.
T.E. Lawrence, yes. T.E. Lawrence was born in Wales in 1888. His father was a baronet, Sir Thomas Chapman, and his mother was Sarah Lawrence. He was born illegitimate.
Oh.
Now, what's interesting about Chapman, his father, is that he had been previously married to a woman named Hamilton, by whom he had four daughters. But then he hooked up with Sarah Lawrence and illegitimately had five sons.
Five sons.
The second of whom was T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia.
Okay, first of all, that whole family dynamic has got to be a little kooky.
It really is, yeah. He has four legitimate daughters and five illegitimate sons.
So do you think the two families ever met?
I'm not aware of that. I haven't come across that. I don't know if the half-brothers and half-sisters met or whatever.
I mean, the women had to know about each other.
I guess. Sir Thomas Chapman moved around a lot. So his sons moved with him and Sarah Lawrence, and they lived in various places in England, even in one of the Channel Islands, I think, for a short period of
time. Why did they move a lot? What did he do?
I don't. He did a lot of things.
It wasn't military or
no.
Anything like that.
And, of course, being illegitimate back then, there was a real stain on the bastard children. And no respectable woman would marry someone like Lawrence. So it was really a very difficult thing to be a bastard back then. Now it doesn't really carry the stigma that it did then.
It doesn't at all anymore.
Not really, no. But back in the 1890s, 1900, and so on, it definitely
did. It was a big deal.
Lawrence, as a boy, was interested in almost everything. He particularly loved the Middle Ages. He eventually ended up at Oxford, where he took first-class honors in history. He traveled extensively in France. His French was so good that Frenchmen asked him what part of France he was from.
That's impressive.
So he spoke perfect French. When he was still at Oxford, before he got his first-class honors, he took a tour of the Middle East and explored Crusader castles, and he wrote his thesis on this, the influence of Crusader castles on military architecture in medieval times, and it was published. So this is a highly intelligent man who knows a lot of things.
At a very young age.
At a very young age. He also was a very enthusiastic bicyclist, and also eventually with motorcycles. In the course of his life, he would own something like 7 or 8 motorcycles. And that is what, well, that is what's going to kill him.
Oh, don't give it away.
In 1910, after Oxford, he went to the Middle East to work with Leonard Woolley and D.G. Hogarth, who were archaeologists, very famous archaeologists. I knew about Woolley when I was a boy because he was just like a giant in archaeology.
And what part of the Middle East are we talking about?
He was at Carchemish, which is basically on the Syrian-Turkish border.
Okay.
Although, remember, at this time, this is all part of the Ottoman Empire. Syria doesn't exist. Turkey doesn't exist. It's just the Ottoman Empire.
I see. What year is this, roughly?
He actually is going to be there from 1910 to 1914 when the war breaks out.
Oh.
So he's going to spend 4 years doing archaeological work and at the same time becoming fluent in Arabic.
Oh, I see.
He seemed
to have a real knack for languages.
Oh, he did. He will eventually translate the Odyssey by Homer from the ancient Greek into English, and that will be published too.
Impressive.
He's a very impressive individual. The war breaks out in August of 1914, World War I. By the end of 1914, he's in the army.
So at that point, had he gone back to England?
He traveled all over the place.
But when he joined up with the army...
Most of the time between 1910 and 1914, he was in the Middle East. I'm not exactly certain how many trips he made back.
I see.
All right. But by the end of 1914, he was in the army, and he was in Cairo and put in the cartography division. That was his chief job, although he did interview prisoners, and he made daily reports for the officers, for the generals. His knowledge of Arabic was, of course, very important. But what happens is, in the course of World War I, the British needed as much help as they could, and their main object was to win the war. So if I can just diverge for a moment from Lawrence while he's in Cairo, you have a situation in 1915, early 1916, called the Hussein McMahon correspondence. Sharif Hussein was the Sharif of Mecca and Medina. He was a direct descendant of Muhammad, I think the 37th or 38th direct descendant of Muhammad, in charge of the holy places in Arabia, which was all controlled by the Ottoman Empire. And McMahon was a high commissioner to Egypt, and Hussein and McMahon had this correspondence known as the Hussein McMahon correspondence, in which the British promised Hussein and the Arabs that after the war, they would create a large Arabian kingdom that Ibn Hussein would be monarch over.
Why would they promise that?
Because they wanted the Arabs to fight with them against the Turks. The Arabs had been dominated by the Turks.
Oh, so it was a reward.
Right. The Arabs had been dominated by the Turks for centuries. And even though both the Turks and the Arabs were Muslim, they didn't particularly get along. Just like even though the French and the English were Christian nations, they didn't particularly get along for centuries either, like the Hundred Years' War. And so that was the main reason, seen from the British point of view. The problem with this is the very next year, you have something called the Sykes-Picot Agreement. Sykes was a British official and Picot was a French official, and they agreed that after the war, that they would kind of divvy up much of the Middle East. France would get Syria, Lebanon.
Which goes completely against the original agreement.
Pretty much goes against the Hussein McMahon correspondence, and Britain would get what would become... what is now Israel, Jordan, Iraq, and so on.
That seems like a backroom deal?
Well, the very next year, in 1917, the British issued what they called the Balfour Declaration.
Oh, Lord. Another one?
Which promised a homeland for the Jews, which, of course, would eventually lead to the British Mandate, which would lead to the creation of the Nation of Israel in 1948. So, in 1915, they're making a deal with the Arabs, the Hussein McMahon correspondence. In 1916, they're making a deal with the French, the Sykes-Picot Agreement. And in 1917, they're promising the Jews a homeland. And basically, there's a lot of overlapping territory here.
I'll say.
Yes.
And that's a lot to promise.
That's a lot to promise.
That doesn't belong to you.
Well, the British felt they would win the war, which they did. And they thought that they should be in charge of huge areas.
Because they knew best?
Perhaps this is a colonialism, but every people engage in colonialism, not just the West.
Doesn't make it right.
No, it doesn't make it right necessarily. I mean, North American Indians engaged in colonialism. The Islamic world did. The Asian world did. Everybody really has been imperialistic, if they can be, if they have the opportunity to be.
The opportunity and the means.
Right. It doesn't exculpate it, but I just want to, you know, bring in all that.
I see.
Anyway, so Lawrence, by the time you get to 1916, okay, he's been working in Cairo for about a year.
Would
or so.
He have heard of all these agreements, or
that's
were they?
A good question. He would have known about the Hussein McMahon correspondence
because those are pretty public.
That was pretty public. The Sykes-Picot Agreement was kept secret, and there is a question as to when Lawrence found out about that.
Oh,
we're
okay.
Not sure when he knew that, because Lawrence was very pro-Arab. And he wanted a large Arabian kingdom, such as the Hussein McMahon correspondence promised.
I see. Okay.
But we don't know when he found out about the Sykes-Picot.
But he eventually did find out.
Eventually did, yes.
Okay.
Right. And I think it kind of irritated him very much.
Well, I would think so.
Right. In 1916, Lawrence was sent to talk with three of the four sons of Ibn Hussein, Faisal, Ali, and Abdullah. He had a fourth son, Zaid.
That's a big deal.
That's a big deal because what happened was in 1916, the Arabs finally decided, because of the Hussein McMahon correspondence, to side with the British, and this is the beginning of the Arab Revolt, which would last from 1916 to 1918 when the war ended. So Lawrence is set in 1916 to go talk with three of the four sons of Ibn Hussein, And Lawrence very quickly determines that Faisal is the most capable of the three. And this is the guy that the British should work with. I might mention that in the great film, 1962 film, Lawrence of Arabia, Prince Faisal is played by the wonderful actor Alec Guinness. And he plays him...
A great performance.
It's a great... Well, let me just say something about the film. The film was made in 62, and it is a great film from a film standpoint, but it takes a lot of liberties.
As Hollywood usually does.
Yes, it takes a lot of liberties. I think it took over, I think, like 15 months to film it in Jordan, in Morocco,
it's
in Spain.
Epic.
It's an epic film, but you have to be careful, very careful.
Don't take
when you
it
watch
all
it.
As right. true history.
Well, Lawrence, because of his knowledge of Arabic, because of the fact he was a courageous man, he was a soldier, he begins to function with the Arab revolt and begins to blow up bridges and railroad lines and tracks. There was a major railroad.
And this is all against the Turks.
It's all against the Turks, right. So the Arabs finally decide, because at first the Arabs were hesitant to join the British, but then they did. And so Lawrence is going to work with the Arab revolt to... He actually convinced Faisal not to engage in formal military attacks because he thought the Turks had too much weaponry and too much training and the Arabs would be slaughtered. So he actually argued for a kind of guerrilla warfare where there would be attacks on all kinds of infrastructure, especially the Hejaz rail line, which went from Damascus to Medina. And Lawrence himself will actually participate in blowing up parts of the rail line and railroad bridges.
So he's fighting alongside them.
He's fighting alongside them, and he's wearing an Arab costume. He's
That's not a costume.
I guess it's not a costume.
No, it's not a costume.
I guess that's very Western and imperialistic.
Yes, it is, indeed. And I'm calling you out on it.
Okay. Thanks, honey.
Anytime, honey. Also, this goes to our age difference, too.
All right. Okay. So Lawrence will take with Abu Abidai, played by Anthony Quinn in the movie, brilliantly. He will take Aqaba in July of 1917.
Which That's is a big deal.
That was a big deal because now the British could bring the Navy and land at Aqaba and get behind the Turks.
Because it was a
Turks.
Big port.
Yeah, it's a port. And it's the taking of Aqaba. The campaign for Aqaba began in May of 17 and it was successful by early July. I think it was July 6th.
Where exactly is Aqaba?
Aqaba is at the head of the Gulf of Aqaba, right there on the border where Israel and Jordan are today.
Okay.
It's one of the two arms of the Red Sea as it goes northwards. The other is the Gulf of Suez on the west side.
I see.
By the way, Lawrence's knowledge of the geography of the Middle East was extraordinary.
Well, because he was a cartographer as well.
Right, and he had spent time there, so it was just one more great talent of his. I mean, it's like he knew every hill and every mountain.
He was completely immersed.
Right. In November of 17, he was actually captured at Deraa, which is in southern Syria today, not far from the Jordanian border. And it was there that he was beaten. And something...
Did they know who he was?
They didn't. A price was on his head by then. They had originally been 5,000 pounds, and then they raised it to 20,000 pounds, which was an enormous sum of money. The Turks put a price on Lawrence's head because they found out about him and so on, helping to lead the Arab revolt. And they didn't know that they had Lawrence in their hands. But he was brutalized in Deraa, and he may have been sexually assaulted. In fact, it's likely. He wrote in his great work, his autobiography about the revolt, The Seven Pillars of Wisdom, that in Deraa that night, the citadel of my integrity was irrevocably lost.
Oh, goodness.
Now, what does that
mean?
Talk
about a euphemism.
What does that mean? The citadel of my integrity was irrevocably lost. Which goes to another feature about Lawrence that has puzzled a lot of people, and that is his sexual nature. Was he homosexual? Was he bisexual? We do not know of a single person he ever had a relationship with.
Not even any close friendships? No. That
well, he had
perhaps...
close friendships with many Arabs, and there is some speculation that he might have had a sexual relationship with a young boy when he was on his archaeological expeditions before the war. But all of this is quite speculative. It's possible, and many have put forward the idea that Lawrence was asexual. He was just not interested in sex at all. I mean, there are some people like that. For the record, I'm not one of them.
Good to know.
But there's a real possibility of that. But there's a real question as to what happened in Dara when he was captured. Then he was released. They didn't know who they had.
They would have, yeah. Would they have?
I don't know.
Well, they wouldn't have killed him. They would have turned him in to get the money.
Well, the soldiers had him and so on. So I don't know. Maybe the soldiers would have gotten it. Yeah, that might have been the case. And, of course, in the film Lawrence of Arabia, the great Jose Ferrer plays the local commander of Dara. That's a great scene. But
oh, that's right.
Right. In any case, Lawrence continues with the Arab revolt into 1918.
So they brutalize him and they just let him out.
They let him out, yeah. They didn't know who they had and they just brutalized him.
So they
him
said,
and let
take
him go.
That.
Yeah.
Don't mess with us again.
There are some people to question that if the Dara incident even occurred. See, this is all part of the
Why
mystery.
Why would they question it?
Well, some people, like an author named Aldington, Richard Aldington, in 1955 wrote a biography of Lawrence in which he said that Lawrence made a lot of things up. Now, I can tell you that the majority of people think that that is not the case, that Lawrence never made things up. But there is a element out there that maintains that Lawrence fictionalized certain things, and the Dara incident might have been one of them. He's all part of the controversy of who this man was. But that he was working with the Arab revolt and blowing up bridges and train tracks and doing all of this is not in doubt. I'm very much inclined, based on what I've read, to think that Lawrence did not make things up. That if you read his work on the Arab revolt, The Seven Pillars of Wisdom, it is magnificent.
Is that what the book is just about?
The Seven Pillars of Wisdom is basically an autobiography about the 2 years he spends with in the Arab revolt.
So it's not his whole life. It's
no,
just
it's not
this
his whole
particular
life.
Period.
No.
Okay.
And it was originally privately published in 1926 after the war, and only publicly published in 1935, the year of Lawrence's death. And there's
This point, among the British, say back in England,
yeah.
Is he becoming a well-known figure?
No, not at this point. That's a good question. During the war, not that many people knew who T.E. Lawrence was, except the British military, and they knew how valuable he was. Now, the head of all British forces in the Middle East was Sir Edmund Allenby.
Oh, the Allenby rule.
Yes, we'll get to that momentarily.
Okay.
And Allenby, played by Jack Hawkins in the film Lawrence of Arabia, brilliantly, Allenby was a very capable commander, and he understood the value of Lawrence and said so, that this was an invaluable British serving officer who was doing great work, you know, helping to lead the Arab revolt. And Lawrence had a real respect for Allenby, and vice versa.
Was that his immediate commanding officer?
Not his immediate commanding officer, but it was his ultimate commanding officer.
I see.
Because Allenby was in charge of the entire Middle Eastern theater.
But they probably had meetings together.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, in fact, Lawrence would go back periodically to Egypt, where Allenby was stationed. Now, Allenby is going to move into northward toward Jerusalem. He'll take Jerusalem in December of 17. The ultimate object was Damascus, and Damascus would be taken in October of 1918 as the World War I is coming to an end. Lawrence wanted to be there first with the Arabs, but he missed it by a few hours, and the British got in there just a few hours before he did. It's interesting, Lawrence was, by the end of the war, promoted to a full colonel status.
Well, let's get back to Damascus.
Okay. Damascus is taken, and by the time Damascus is taken in October of 1918, World War I is on the verge of ending. And so the Arab revolt has been successful. The British have been successful in the Middle East.
So now the Arabs are expecting their reward.
That's right. And now that takes you to the Paris Peace Conference at Versailles in 1919. And in fact, Lawrence in early 1919 was part of Faisal's delegation. And he was at the Versailles Peace Conference, where Woodrow Wilson and others were, of course. And he did not like the deal that the Arabs were getting, so he left. Eventually, he will join the Foreign Office, and then eventually he will work for Winston Churchill for about a year in the Colonial Office. That's another thing about Lawrence. He knew a lot of famous people. George Bernard Shaw, Winston Churchill, the painter Augustus John, Gertrude Bell.
I don't know who a lot of those people are.
Well, Gertrude Bell was an expert on the Middle East. She was fluent in Arabic. We could do an entire podcast on her. You know who Winston Churchill is. Augustus
right.
John was a painter, and George Bernard Shaw was a great writer.
I know
writer.
Him, right.
Okay. And he knew a lot of other individuals. In fact, a lot of Lawrence's publications, and he has a lot of publications, not just Seven Pillars of Wisdom and the work on the Crusader Castles and the translation of the Odyssey, but a lot of his letters have been published.
I see. Okay.
And he wrote other works like The Wilderness of Zen and so on. I mean, this is a fascinating man. He's a soldier. He's courageous. He's smart.
He's a linguist. He's a cartographer.
He's just an extraordinary human being. So you had asked how famous he was during the war. He really wasn't that famous because the British didn't want to advertise him because they knew that he'd be in greater danger.
Right? I see. That makes sense.
It's only after the war in 1919, 1920, 21 that he becomes known to the British public for what he did during the war. And this was principally due to an American journalist, Lowell Thomas.
Okay.
And Lowell Thomas really built him up and had photos of him and so on. And Lawrence, there was a part of Lawrence that kind of liked this, but there was another part of Lawrence which was very shy and he didn't like it. But nonetheless, it's only really after the war that his reputation soars, not just in Britain, but across the world. And he's known virtually everywhere as Lawrence of Arabia. The shy part of Lawrence, the reclusive part of Lawrence, did not like this, and he actually joined the Royal Air Force, the RAF, under an assumed name, Ross. He took another name. And then, eventually, he would join temporarily the Tank Corps, and he would take another name, Shaw.
My goodness, it's almost like he had an identity crisis. He didn't know who he was.
I think he was an extremely private man and a very complex individual. And I think
in a way, he kind of sounds like a tortured soul.
I think that many people have concluded that, yes, that he was a very tortured soul. I think that that's correct, but a man of extraordinary talents. He lived in London. He bought a cottage in Dorset that he loved. I think it was called Clouds Hill. He spent a lot of time there. He wrote The Seven Pillars of Wisdom, which I mentioned.
So once he left the Middle East, did he ever go back?
He spent time. Actually, he would end up in India for a couple years.
Oh, with the British.
With the British, because he's still in the service in the 1920s. He would not leave the British service until March of 1935, just 2 months before his death. So to get to how he dies in 1935, he loved motorcycles, as I mentioned before.
So where is he logistically?
Where he's going to die is in Dorset. The cottage he loved, he went there many times and so on. And
so he just gets back from...
He goes out of the service in March of 35. And in May of 35, he's in Dorset at his cottage, and he has, I think, his seventh or eighth motorcycle. And he goes on a motorcycle ride, and he was going, they estimate, close to 100 miles an hour on the motorcycle. And there were two boys on bicycles that he saw as he came up a hill, and he tried to avoid them, and it killed him. I mean, he crashed. And he died 6 days later after the accident.
Did he hit the boys?
Nope, he didn't hit the boys. He avoided them, but it cost him his life. So he goes through all these dangers in World War I, fighting the Turks, and he's eventually killed in a motorcycle accident in 1935.
The irony of that.
Right. But by the time of his death, he was this heroic figure. Churchill had a very high opinion of him. He thought The Seven Pillars of Wisdom was a magnificently written work, and I would recommend it to anyone, but be prepared for the fact that he writes a very unusual type of prose.
It's almost like he speaks in metaphors.
A lot of times. It's a very unusual way of writing, but it's fascinating. And it's hundreds of thousands of words. It's not a short work. He did write an abridgment of it called Revolt in the Desert, which was published in 26.
He wrote his own abridged version.
He wrote his own abridged version of Seven Pillars of Wisdom. That's right. And it's also at this time that he translates the Odyssey from ancient Greek to English. He's an amazing figure. And I've rarely studied anybody quite like him. And he was only 46 when he died.
Now, did he have any relationship with his brothers?
As far as, especially his youngest brother, Arnold, who didn't die until 1991.
91?
No, Arnold lived into his 90s. And he very much protected his brother's reputation because he felt people like Aldington, he felt the film Lawrence of Arabia distorted his brother, did not tell the truth about him. So Arnold Lawrence, who himself was a great scholar on classical architecture, classical art, wrote many works on antiquity, he did his best to salvage his brother's reputation and attack those who he thought treated with Lawrence unfairly.
Well, it's interesting because the movie is not an unflattering portrayal of Lawrence.
No, it's not an unflattering. One of the criticisms of the movie is that it made Lawrence too pro-Arab. And
but he was
so indecisive. Well, a lot of people think the reality was he was definitely more pro-British and was not as divided between his loyalty to Britain and the Arabs as the movie kind of makes it out
well,
to be.
Well, the fact that he left the Paris treaty talks.
Well, he could be disgusted with the way the Arabs were treated, but he was very much a British serving officer. And there was a passage in the Seven Pillars of Wisdom, I'm trying to recall what page, where he talks about how he could never be an Arab, but he could pretend not to be as British as he was, indicating that he really was very British. But I'm just saying that's a criticism of the movie, that they make him too pro-Arab.
Okay.
And that he didn't have as divided a laurel
of according to his brother.
According to his brother and according to many biographers and according to many other commenters, yeah. So this is another mystery about
Wallace. I see. How is he looked upon in the Arab world?
Oh, very high.
Still.
I think that, to this day.
He's a hero.
Yeah. He's an heroic figure, to my knowledge, to this day, because he did everything promoting the Arabs. He thought that the original Hussein McMahon correspondence should have been honored, which it wasn't. He's particularly not liked in France because he did not want the French to get Syria and Lebanon, which they did. And so the French kind of developed an attitude toward Lawrence, which was hostile because of that.
Well, I mean, the French kind of underhandedly usurped the first agreement and...
Well, so did the British. You have the Sykes-Picot agreement kind of glossing over the previous Hussein-McMahon correspondence, and then you have the Balfour Declaration. You see how complicated it gets. But it's the Middle East. And in defense of the British, to the extent that there is a defense, they needed to win the war. And you do whatever you have to win the war. And then
you make alliances that you would never make otherwise.
Right, and then you have to deal with the fallout afterwards. Yeah.
So where is he buried, do we know?
I think Westminster Abbey.
Oh, really?
I believe.
Did he get a state funeral?
No, state funerals are only for royalty or an extraordinary human being.
Like Churchill.
Like Wellington or Churchill, yes. Princess Diana got a state funeral, too. She was technically not part of the royal family by that time, but they gave her a state funeral anyway.
Which was probably the right thing to do.
Mm. But his funeral was very well attended, and
it would have been in London, probably.
Oh, yeah. Right, even though he was killed in Dorset.
Right. Mm. That's what I was thinking.
Well, that's where his accident took place. He died 6 days after that. So, this is this heroic figure who helps to lead. He wasn't just the only leader, but he helps to lead the Arab revolt.
Was he the only Brit in that position?
There were a few others. No, there were a few other British officers at times changing, communicating with Lawrence, going along with Lawrence. I think a man named Storrs and others, they were there. But it's really Lawrence and his... You know, and he wears Arab attire. How's that? Instead of costume.
Attire, I see. Okay. Uh-huh.
And traditional garb, as one CNN reporter referred to someone years ago. And, he takes on the trappings of Arab life. And I think he loved the Arabs. I think he had a very high opinion of them.
Now, as far as religion, was
he... He remained nominally a Christian.
I see. So he never went over to...
No, he never converted to Islam.
Because I'm sure he had a deep understanding of Islam.
I don't really... Yeah, I think he had a deep understanding of a lot of things. But yes, absolutely. He could recite passages from the Quran in classical Arabic by heart. He was...
I don't know that I'd want to have dinner with him, though, I have to say.
I think he was... He's not the kind of guy
you want to take out for a beer.
He kind of reminds me of, in personality-wise, of Michelangelo in the sense that Michelangelo said, "I have no friends and I don't want any." Michelangelo was a loner with his painting, his sculpture, his architectural designs. And I think that Lawrence very much was a loner, but there was another part of Lawrence that did enjoy the fame. And did enjoy knowing famous people like Churchill and George Bernard Shaw and others. So I think he was torn himself.
I wish he had lived long enough to see the height of Churchill.
Yes, I wish he had lived another 15 years. And who knows, he could have functioned in a very important position in World War II.
My guess is he would have.
Yeah, because he was not that old. I mean, he was 14 years younger than Churchill. So that is the life of this enigmatic, highly talented,
strange,
extraordinary man. And I recommend the film to everyone, the 1962 David Lean film,
yes.
Lawrence of Arabia. I think Peter O'Toole's performance is magnificent, but be careful with it.
The fact that he didn't win the Oscar for that performance is mind-boggling.
Yes, I think it's one of the greatest performances on screen I've ever seen.
And the film itself is epic.
Oh, yeah. It's one.
I mean, no wonder it took a year and a half to make.
And the people in it, Omar Sharif
and
Alec
names.
Guinness. And you
Not many women, I have to say.
No, women are almost completely absent.
There's only, I think, one scene.
Yeah, where they're just in the background.
Right, where they're cheering on the men.
Right. But that's about it. There's virtually no women in the film. But
I guess they didn't have much a part in
no. But
the
role of actor, I mean, you have Anthony Quinn, Anthony Quayle. I mean, the list goes on of great actors in that film.
Omar Sharif.
Yeah, Jack Hawkins. Claude Rains.
Oh, Claude.
Yes, Claude Rains plays the diplomat.
It's funny, we should tell our listeners, we feel like we have a very special relationship with Claude Rains, even though we never met him.
You want to tell him or you want me to tell him?
You tell him.
Well, we're fortunate to have a vacation home in New Hampshire, and we found out that Claude Rains, in his old age, bought a farm in New Hampshire, in Sandwich, New Hampshire.
Which is very close to where we are.
Right, and he is buried very close to his home, and we've been to that gravesite many times.
We try to go at least once a year, if not more.
And it's just this little graveyard.
You would never know.
You'd never know that this
one
famous
of the greatest
actors. I think he is one of the greatest actors I've ever seen.
I mean, he taught Laurence Olivier.
Yes, and as the police constable in Casablanca, he's perfect.
In almost every film, The Invisible Man.
Yeah, The Invisible Man is what really made him. This is one of his last films. He was an old man by the time he did Lawrence of Arabia. He died in 67. The film was made in 62. But
it's definitely worth, the 3.5 hours?
Yes, it's a very long film, but it is a
fascinating film. There is an intermission.
Yes, there is an intermission.
Just FYI. Right. Okay, this has been fascinating. I mean, what a guy.
Yes, one of the immortals, Lawrence of Arabia.
He'll
always be known that way.
Okay, well, what do we have on tap for next time?
I think what we're doing next time is the Crimean War.
Which is kind of fascinating considering our current climate.
Yes, considering what's going on in Ukraine and such, I mean, we'll be dealing with an area that is, was part of Ukraine until 2014. Russia took it over in 2014. And there is a very nasty war fought there in the 1850s, the Crimean War, which we'll cover. Yeah, and it also gives rise to modern nursing because of Florence Nightingale. So there's a lot of things.
Ooh, I can't wait to hear about this.
There's a lot of things associated with the Crimean War that are quite
tragic.
Tragic.
I don't
want to
make light of it, for sure.
No. It's really the first photographed war, too.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to episode 41.
41.
So this is episode 40, signing off. So everyone stay well, stay safe, and until next time.
So long.
Well, friends, here we are at the end of the podcast. Be sure to check out the links in the show description to find some of the resources we used for this episode. Also, if you've enjoyed listening, please head over to Apple Podcasts and give us a virtual high five by leaving us a 5-star review. We'd really appreciate that. And if you'd like to connect with us directly, you can find us at historicallyspeakingpodcast.com or follow us on Instagram at historicallyspeakingpodcast. That's it for today. And again, thanks for sharing part of your day with us. And remember, if you want to know what the future holds, study the past.